This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. Stay tuned for all things chocolate with Harrison Berg's Brad Burrow and his business adventures in the world of fair trade chocolate. That's the subject of this week's episode of The Spark, coming up. Also, in honor of the 100th birthday of the National Park Service, that was on Friday, we revisit Jordy Yeager's story about Shenandoah National Park's sound artist, Diane Ballin. But first, a report this summer revealed deep problems at the Rockbridge Department of Social Services, problems so serious they may have contributed to the death of at least one child. A criminal investigation is underway. WMRA's Jesse Nadler has this report.
Rockbridge County residents gathered on August 11th to discuss serious dysfunction with the local Department of Social Services, or DSS. Around 30 people showed up. Bill Burleson, temporary director of the Rockbridge agency, a handful of Lexington City leaders, at least one school board member. It was a thin turnout considering the severity of the situation. The meeting was called in the aftermath of a highly critical report conducted by the Social Services Piedmont Regional Office in Roanoke, which oversees Rockbridge DSS. The report described how the Rockbridge agency had been ignoring, improperly invalidating, and even shredding documents pertaining to the physical abuse and/or neglect of children and older adults. It described a work environment so dysfunctional that when a complaint of suspected child abuse would come into the Rockbridge office, employees did not record the complaint into a formal database.
Missing or shredded.
Susan Reese, head of the Piedmont Regional Office, who spoke at the forum, explained this disconnect is why it took so long for her office to figure out what was going on. Instead, employees were told to prepare cases in an unofficial Word document and give them to Brenda Perry. Employees weren't aware of what happened to complaints after that point. Some were investigated, but others were forgotten or even destroyed. When employees became suspicious, some began making copies of reports. Complaints to the agency director went nowhere. Such actions may have had fatal consequences. At least one child, a 3-month-old infant, died in April after an initial Child Protective Services report assessed the child's living conditions as, quote, high risk, but no additional services were offered. A criminal investigation is now underway. Brenda Perry has been forced out of her job. Agency director Meredith Downey resigned. 180 abuse or neglect cases have been reexamined. Of those, 51 have been reopened for investigation. 27 are considered serious enough to warrant immediate DSS action.
Obviously, because of the magnitude and scope of this, this is one of the reasons we've decided to impanel a special grand jury to assist us in really looking at all the various facets and the people that are working there to see whether or not and to what degree there could be criminal culpability.
Chris Bilius is Rockbridge County Commonwealth's attorney. A special grand jury is comprised of up to 11 citizens tasked with investigating whether a crime has been committed. They'll likely be impaneled in September.
We are limited to Rockbridge County and the city of Lexington, but we can look at any activity that touches upon anything that might have occurred in Rockbridge County. So as far as culpability goes, we don't really know how far it goes.
It's heartbreaking. But more than heartbreaking, it is so frustrating.
Karen Fleetwood is a mental health professional. She was at the August 11th forum with two former colleagues from the Buena Vista office of Virginia Home-Based Counseling. One of her colleagues revealed at the forum that copies of her professional licenses had been shredded because the services supervisor was so opposed to collaborating with outside service providers.
You're part of the system. And you get blamed for the breakdown within the system. There's nothing you can do. There's nobody else that you can go to and demand more answers. And you're already risking your reputation with your family by reporting to CPS.
She's referring to the families in crisis for whom she provides counseling.
And when CPS doesn't follow through, you know, it's so frustrating because you see the breakdown in the system. And then you see families that continue to live in situations of abuse and poverty and neglect. Who do they have that's going to help them? CPS is supposed to be helping, and they leave them.
Questions arose at the forum about more structural failings, specifically the lack of oversight at both the board and regional office levels. Yes, the regional office published the scathing review, but child welfare advocate Susan Lawrence says she's been complaining to the regional office about Rockbridge DSS for a decade.
I think I'm well aware of the systemic issues that occur in the social service office.
Her own adopted son, now in his mid-20s, ended up in 8 years of what she describes as unnecessary and hellish foster care because Rockbridge DSS never processed the paperwork that would have allowed Lawrence to adopt him when he was eight. She complained to the regional office for years, but nothing came of it.
The boards are supposed to run the agency and be accountable for that. In reality, what happens in Virginia is nobody really tells the boards that, and they don't receive training on how to run an agency like this. So they just rubber stamp everything that comes to them each month. Then if you go to a state level, the state says, well, they're not really in charge of the local agency because it's not a state agency. And then you talk to the board, and they say, well, we're not in charge of the agency because it's run by the state. And then you talk to the supervisors and the city council members, and they're like, we're definitely not in charge. And so you have these agencies all across the state that are just doing whatever they want.
Susan Reese agreed at the forum that the system is, quote, confusing. She confirmed that localities have a great deal of discretion when it comes to policy. They decide whether to screen out a complaint of abuse or neglect, and that the local social services board bears much of the responsibility. Indeed, the Virginia Social Services Handbook for local board members states that administrative boards are responsible for, among many things, the review of personnel performance and the provision of child welfare services. But the regional office's report found there hasn't been any background checks completed on Rockbridge DSS personnel since 2001, and not a single board member attended the August 11th community forum. Susan Lawrence filed a complaint against Virginia DSS with the Department of Justice on August 24th. For WMRA News, I'm Jesse Nadler.
We're going to continue to follow this story as it unfolds in Rockbridge County in the coming months as a special grand jury is expected to be impaneled in September. When you think of an artist in residence, you might think of a painter or a potter or maybe even a poet. But what about an artist whose medium is sound? Well, that perked the ears of WMRA's Jordy Yeager, who tagged along with veteran sound storyteller Diane Ballin.
On a recent Wednesday, the sun had barely risen, and parking lots along the winding Skyline Drive were still empty, except for one car. Outside it, a woman from Portland, Maine, gently made her way down one of the most popular trails in Shenandoah National Park. She was the first one out that day, and she was on a mission.
My name is Diane Ballin. I am a sound artist, and I am the artist in residence at Shenandoah National Park. We've come down to Dark Hollow Falls to record some of the falls. And this is actually my first recording at the park.
Chances are you've heard Ballin's work. She's been making radio since back in the 1980s when cassette recorders were cutting edge. But her pieces aren't your standard who, what, where, why reports like this one. Rather, they're works of art, like poetic sound.
When I saw Diane's application, it was for a sound installation. I was immediately intrigued.
Lisa Wilkolak is an administrative assistant for natural and cultural resources at Shenandoah National Park.
Then I went online and listened to all of her recordings that she has available and just thought it was such a unique and different way to look at a place that people often assume is just a physical beauty and people don't necessarily pay attention to the sounds that they hear. So I was, interested in hearing what she heard when she visited us.
Back in Dark Hollow Falls, Ballin puts down her giant microphone, takes off her large headphones, and stops her recorder.
What I love about sound is that we create the visuals. The sound creates a visual. With video or film, which is also, a beautiful art, the visual is created for you. I really love the challenge of creating visual with sound and how personal that is to the person who's listening, as well as the producer.
Birds, waterfalls, streams, scurrying squirrels, sure. But there's another key sound in these woods.
Hey, we're at Dark Hollow Falls. It's about 9 a.m. I just jumped in the swimming hole at the bottom of the falls and stood underneath the falls. Quite refreshing, better than a cup of coffee.
Dennis Mathewson is a physical therapist from Amherst, Massachusetts. He and his family are vacationing in the park like dozens of others Ballin talks with over the course of the morning. an IT manager and a middle school teacher from Chicago, a pair of best friends from Indiana and New York, a family from London, another from Austria, all have come to experience the wild of the park.
I love it. Nothing like nature. I mean, this is where we belong. If you sit there in the quiet is almost like a physical presence, and you just sit there and you feel part of it, you know?
Tom Knuth has come all the way from Wisconsin.
Just went out alone in the woods. Yeah. It becomes a physical presence. I can almost feel the silence. Reach out, grab it. I get emotional about it. It's really pretty cool.
Knuth's not alone in getting choked up. Almost everyone we meet has a visceral reaction to being in the park, and Balin is there to capture it. Wilkolak says that in just the 1 week that she spent with Balin, it's changed how she sees, or rather, hears, the park.
My favorite part is that she gets so excited about sounds, and everything she hears, she's thinking about the possibility of using it or how it applies to something, you know, so she looks at the world in a different way. She looks at the world through sound, and it's made me spend time listening and seeing the world through sound rather than sight or smell.
Balin's pieces aren't gratuitous. She doesn't use sound just to fill space. Whether the focus is on dogs and their owners, or bird watchers, or boats creaking on docks in Iceland, Balin creates audio journeys where every sound is a guidepost, a subtle move and transition within the piece, delicately shaping and charting a broader story. Here at the park, she's not exactly sure what form the eventual piece will take quite yet, but she guesses it'll be about 10 minutes long. It'll live at the visitor center near Big Meadows for people from all over the world to come experience. For now, she's happy just basking in the sounds.
I don't worry about, you know, how it's going to work. I just am there at the moment. I think this is the best part of recording, because you're not sitting at the bench saying, oh, you know, there's that sound in the background I don't want. It's like discovery. And you don't know exactly what you're going to get. And it's always a beautiful surprise.
For WMRA News, I'm Jordy Yeager.
I think roller derby is a hopeful thing.
He earned enough money from selling plants that he paid off the mortgage on his house.
People always want to know, is that a lie or is that the truth?
I completely disassembled this Triumph TR6.
I wish I could have been a professional woman soccer player.
I'm Martha Woodruff, and this is The Spark, an exploration of interesting people doing interesting things. The Spark this week concerns the power of chocolate, not just to taste good, but to do good. In his mid-20s, Harrisonburg's Brad Burrow got an MBA from the University of Kansas with the idea of using it to do good. So naturally, I asked him to define what he means by doing good.
Doing something good. So any sort of what might be called today a socially responsible enterprise, or working maybe for some positive environmental organization, I don't know, that builds solar panels or lobbies for recycling, something that takes care of people or takes care of our environment, rather than just working as a means to making money. Just because I feel like for me to be motivated to get up and go somewhere every day for an extended period of time, I need to be enjoying what I'm doing, and not, I can't fake myself out when it comes to that.
Now, plenty of people arrive in their 20s and want to make money, and you want to be involved in something that appears to make the world a better place.
In a very broadly speaking, I don't know. I guess it sounds weird, but it's a self-serving thing as well, too, which I think a lot of this, what appears to be altruistic, is also self-serving, because that's what makes me feel like I'm doing something with purpose that's it. No one's ever asked me where that came from, so now I'm wondering, where did that come from?
It's good dueling careers kept Brad and his wife Stephanie Warlick in Lawrence, Kansas for 10 years, then took them to Chapel Hill and finally to Baltimore in 2006. By that time, Brad had held jobs that engaged him and put his MBA to use, but weren't ideal because they didn't quite scratch his doing good itch. Oh, and by the way, Brad, now left unemployed by the move to Baltimore, is quite the soccer fan.
So, 2006, relocated to a new place. 2006 was also the summer of a World Cup that was happening. So it was a great time to be unemployed. We found a great place we moved into, really close to the water in Baltimore. It was a vibrant, slightly dangerous, but exciting place to live. Very closely located to a lot of establishments that were showing the World Cup. So by the end of the World Cup, I would run down, watch a first half. They would put my beer on ice. I'd run home, send some resumes out, come back, watch the second half. You know, again, I'm looking for ideal jobs, and this opening came up for Divine Chocolate, which is a fair trade chocolate company, was starting to launch a U.S. company. They were based in the U.K. at the time, but distributing in the U.S. through a different organization. And they were looking to start a U.S. company and trying to start getting the first people in place to do that.
Do you remember what you felt when you saw
that? I remember reading that job description, reading about the company, and at this time I didn't know much about fair trade, so I was researching that and thought, this is it, this is it. I'm picturing myself now sitting in the little room at the top of this, you know, three-story row house in Baltimore, furiously typing everything they requested. You know, they asked for, I forget how many words of what fair trade meant to me. And
now, wait a minute, let me interrupt you.
Yep.
What did fair trade mean to you after you researched it?
Fair trade as a business model looks to try and, in a broad sense, level the playing field between folks like us in this nice developed world we live in versus people that, you know, basic needs like clean water, like a few meals a day for a year. So they focus on long-term relationships to try and make sure people are getting paid fairly and they're getting what they need in the sense of just basics.
As opposed to
the business model of keeping people like that faceless and nameless to where it's easier to just indulge and increase the gap between rich and poor because you don't make that connection with the folks on the other end of what it is you're eating, drinking, listening to music through, whatever the case might be.
What position were you applying for?
So this was an operations and logistics manager.
Okay. Tell me about Divine Chocolate. What makes it divine?
Well, the business model makes it divine. It's one of those double entendres, I guess. So it's fair trade business model. It's also one of the first farmer-owned chocolate companies. So the farmers cooperative that grows the cocoa in Ghana, they actually own part of the company because it was essentially their idea to say, hey, we're growing all this cocoa. We rarely get to see what chocolate is like as a finished product. How come we can't have a part of this company? And the folks in the UK were like, you're exactly right. How come you can't? So they helped get that going and they had representation on the board. And now actually that sort of business model is becoming a little bit more common too in the fair trade world at least.
So you get the job. What is the job?
The job at first was, all right, we need an office. We need things to put in the office, telephones, desks, computers, we need all this. So I kind of was doing a lot of costing and proposing what types of things we should get. And they sent me to the Divine offices in the UK just to train with my counterpart there for a few days just to get a little bit more background.
That's real hardship work.
Oh, yeah, it was. Yeah, it was fun. I mean, since this was a small company, started out small, we were wearing multiple hats. So I came up with an ordering system, invoicing, making connections with customers, new customers. We did have a sales director, but I was facilitating moving of chocolate once it got into port. You know, I mean, the whole distribution network, basically, I kind of oversaw a lot of that and kept communication all the ways from manufacturer to the retailer.
All right, you were in business. Your job was to make the business run.
Correct.
Did it feel different in any way than a business of more traditional values?
It did, for sure. It was just evident in learning about the company. But then when I went to the UK company, talked to the folks there, it felt even more special. And then within the year, we were bringing in farmers to come and share their story. And my first time meeting some of the farmers, hearing them say, yeah, this has really changed our lives. And they really focused on women's empowerment, too. So the women are like, yes, my husband no longer takes the money and spends it all. Like, we are in control of our lives here.
Woo! Seven years ago, life took Brad Burrow to Harrisonburg, where he now manages Artisan's Hope, a fair trade shop that incidentally sells Divine Chocolate. You'll find a picture of Brad plus a link to Artisan's Hope and Divine Chocolate on the Spark page at WMRA.org.
Everybody in the world likes chocolate.
Chocolate.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Les and Johnny Grady, Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, the Just Pax Fund, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund at the Community Foundation of Harrisonburg in Rockingham County. If you'd like to learn more about how we fund our news and how you can help, go to WMRA.org, mouse over News, then click on News and Information Fund. Find all of our stories from the newsroom at WMRA.org, and be sure to click like on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio, and follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's News Director and Morning Edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning. I hope you enjoy the rest of your Sunday.